My name is Michael McCusker. I have the windows open here in the otherwise airtight studio, so you might hear some community noises outside, but it's such a beautiful day, this May 2nd. And I'd like to start my program off with something I wrote. Matter of fact, most of everything on this program is going to be something I wrote, so I'll give the disclaimer that what you're about to hear this next half hour is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all of the cosmos. Or is it cosmi, plural? I'd like to start with something that is a perennial. I run it almost every year, revise it just a little bit of skosh, but yesterday was May Day. And that's what this is exactly about. May Day. A call for rebellion, a call for change, a call for help. May Day. The ancient celebration of spring, the festival of rebirth. May Day is celebrated all over the world in every culture and kitchen. For many, it is Labor Day in honor of the anonymous billions who break their backs or wear out their nerves for their daily bread. It is the symbol of seeding the earth in hope of a good harvest to ease the dreadful hunger that stalks the human race. May Day is also a day of revolution, a charge against history that demands sweeping changes among the world's societies. This claim usually originates from compassion and the perception that there is no excuse for anyone to go hungry, be without shelter, or denied adequate health and medical care. It is the demand for freedom and respect of all the world's people. The world situation perpetually eludes optimists and idealists. The future blows a sour breath at the present. Earthquakes, fires, floods, and epidemics ravage the planet. Peace is not on the earth, but a few feet under it for millions who die from war, hunger, disease, or abuse. The balance of wealth and distribution of resources is dismally inequitable, which intensifies the disparity between rich and poor. Millions are out of work, their lives ruined by poverty and economic collapse. Millions more die from famine and epidemics. Oppression, tyranny, and corruption infect the world's governments. World leaders move pitilessly against their own peoples and their neighbors. Armies and police kill innocent people in retaliation for terrorist acts, which perpetuates terrorism. Populations are the major targets of wars, contrary to pious perfidy, which makes war itself a foremost and persistent act of enormous terrorism. The terror of world annihilation looms iconically. 68 years after the first atomic bombs obliterated two Japanese cities and gave birth to the nuclear age. We have built a global greenhouse and we dwell within. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup. But the consequences of our careless and excessive indulgence are converging approximate with our disregard and denial. Our probable proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem helpless as well as unwilling to undo the damage or change direction. Our paradox is that our opulent civilization is based on processes that threaten to obliterate it. We will most likely strangle on the effluence of our affluence. The millennium is an X-ray of our history which lies behind us like an immense junkyard that seems cluttered with artifacts of no use to us anymore. Very little will remain in conscious memory of the 20th century. Images of Adolf Hitler and the mushroom cloud might continue through the centuries. We try to escape history as if by accelerating past we are Teflon'd, but history brought us to where we are and made us who we are. This new millennium evokes old prophecies. Apocalyptic cults that believe the end of history is at hand flourish and seize theolytical power all over the world. Inexorable bipolar dogmata, armed with the means to achieve what ancient prophecy continues to incite. The poets might be right after all. the prospect of peace is more irrational than the dark, brooding desire for murder each of us hosts like a malevolent gene. Humanity's penchant for sinister error, folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror gives us our sense of humor, our appreciation of the comedy of inescapable death. Yet optimism persists. Perhaps because, even in the worst of times, our predecessors always raised a maypole for themselves and their children to dance around. Perhaps in especially the worst times, it is necessary to hope. And that is something I wrote and continually revise, and most often read it at about this time every year. May Day. I'd like to read something now, again, something I wrote. And the disclaimer is still in existence here. Yesterday and the day before yesterday are when the Vietnam War really ended. In 1975, April 30th and May 1st, 1975, 38 years ago. So I'd like to read a couple of things that I've written, sort of the consequences, you might say, that still linger. And again, perhaps I've read this on the air, but I doubt that I have. I call it After the War. And a quote, "Rape is not a crime of passion. It is an act of aggression." And that's from Vietnam, A Feminist Analysis, Rough Times, Volume 2. Nearly four decades since the Vietnam War ended, its veterans have slipped into the American consciousness, though not quite into its conscience. The men and women who returned from a dirty, unpopular Asian war have been shut out, guilt-ridden, tormented still by nightmares of guilt and death. Vietnam veterans are treated as if they were themselves responsible for the war, while its real perpetrators retain power or significantly influence American policy. Almost always out of sync with their peers who remained at home, seemingly indifferent and distant, off across the ocean in a jungle, still every day on patrol. Years afterward, it is worse for many. Delayed stress, post-traumatic disorder, the terrible memories held in like a clenched fist, unravel unexpectedly. The consequences have been grim. A Black Medal of Honor winner tries to rob a grocery store in Detroit and is shot and killed by its owner. A white veteran with a drug habit hangs himself in a run-down Portland, Oregon hotel. An ex-Marine wildly shoots up a parking lot outside a Northern California bar and kills a man he had argued with. Another former Marine murders a young Vietnamese refugee in Queens, New York. The story of the refugee's death is as simple as it is stark. Louis Kahan walked through an 11-year time warp from 1977 to 1966. He left the Queens and went on search and destroy in the rubble of South Vietnam. He took a 17-year-old Vietnamese girl as prisoner. She had no identification card. He accused her of being Viet Cong. She denied it. He raped her and accused her again. She still denied it. He killed her. He looked through the bags she carried. He found nothing to indicate she was a Viet Cong guerrilla. Only school books. Li Mai Han was a student at a high school a few blocks away. She was the daughter of Li Tan Huang Dan, who as a teacher and scholar had been an honored person in Vietnam, but in the USA was a security guard and an insurance salesman. The Li family had been in the U.S. 2 years since the fall of Saigon in 1975 as a result of Mrs. Li's employment with Chase Manhattan Bank. Li Mai Han had begged her parents to emigrate. She had been an exceptional student in the American high school. After he killed Li Mai Han, he strangled her with his hands, Former Marine Cahan returned in 1977. He recalled murdering Li Maihan, only distantly, at first refused to believe it. He left the remodeled apartment house he murdered her in, but returned and found her body in a room. He surrendered to police the next day. The war never ended for Louis Cahan. In Vietnam, he survived brief and costly ambushes and firefights against an enemy that disappeared into the ground or jungle. He spent almost all his waking hours looking for someone to kill. At night, he waited in a bunker or in a hastily dug hole for an enemy to attack and kill him. He claimed to have an extra duty, executioner of prisoners. At home, he drifted. A love affair ended badly because he could not level out. He couldn't hold a job. He drank heavily and used drugs. He did not particularly like his family. His father was an angry, critical man who never amounted to much. His mother was indifferent. Yet he came to roost in his mother's apartment in Queens after his father died. For 2 years, he hardly emerged on the street. After his mother left for work in the mornings, he took weapons he had collected out of a closet and distributed them at each window. He sat in front of television all day with a loaded shotgun at his feet. The guns were put away just before his mother's return each afternoon and taken out again when she was asleep. He stayed awake, on watch, every night. His mind decayed into paranoia. Vietnamese were attempting to kill him. He had to defend the apartment/bunker against them if they found him and attacked. After 2 years, he began to suspect he was losing his grip. Lucid periods were rare. He thought about seeing a psychiatrist. On the day he declared he must do something, 10 Vietnamese refugee families moved en masse into his apartment building. That was why he killed Li Maihan. Cahan was found not guilty by reason of insanity in 1979. It was not an easy verdict for Judge Bernard Dubin to reach. "I think this was a vicious, brutal thing that was done here," the judge said angrily. "A little girl's life was taken viciously, cruelly, and I have no sympathy for the defendant, none whatsoever. He broke a twig, a little girl. Can't waste sympathy on someone who does something like that." It wasn't that simple. Yet it was. Cahan was driven to, quote, do something like that because the system the judge represented required it of him. Judge Dubin ruled against his own instincts. He felt the evidence compelled him to declare that Cahan was innocent of deliberate rape and murder in New York City. He had murdered the Vietnamese girl while he was in Vietnam. Li Maihan died because her killer was sick, alienated, depressed, and afraid, like thousands of other veterans. By 1985, anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million Vietnam veterans were estimated to suffer degrees of delayed stress, or as it later became known as PTSD. Li Maihan also died because rapes and murders were common in Vietnam during interrogation. It was Cahan's duty, as he thought it was expected of him. It was routine, if extreme. Prisoners captured by Americans fared little better than those taken by their South Vietnamese counterparts. It was also understood that prisoners turned over to the South Vietnamese army would most likely be tortured, raped if they were women, and killed. Prisoners were pushed out of helicopters or executed in sight of other prisoners who awaited interrogation. In rural villages and hamlets, wholesale roundups by American Marines and soldiers began the initial cycle of a seemingly endless circle of interrogation. Electrical torture with wires attached to sensitive parts of the body, such as genitals, nose, ears, and tongue, was accompanied by tying Vietnamese men, women, and often children to trees and allowing snarling scout dogs, usually large dogs, to leap at them, often biting off chunks of skin, or they were simply beaten with fists and rifle butts. Everyone in even the most rural hamlet was checked for an identification card. Li Maihan did not have an ID card, which made her a Viet Cong suspect to be interrogated quickly and effectively. Rape was part of the process. So was murder. Superficial attempts were made by U.S. military officials to prosecute cases of outright murder, or as in the case of Army Lieutenant William Calley for his conduct at My Lai Village in 1968 of mass cold-blooded butchery. At the time Cahan was in Vietnam, a USMC squad was brought to military trial, accused of the deaths of 11 Vietnamese villagers near the giant marine base at Chu Lai. The squad had been sent into a village in search of a woman suspected of being a prostitute, serving the Viet Cong as a spy. The Marines burst into her home, and each member of the squad raped her. The last man pointed a pistol at her head and shot her. The Marines packed 10 other villagers, most of them old, into a hut and killed them with rifles. The hut was set afire. Under the direction of the platoon leader, a first lieutenant, the squad returned to the village later the same day and scattered the charred corpses in bushes along a trail to make it appear they had been killed while ambushing the Marines. But another Marine saw the attempt to cover up the murders. He also saw two of the squad members club a baby to death. They had found the baby in a hut, probably hidden by its mother just before she was executed. One of the Marines put straw over the baby's face so he would not have to look at it, he said at his trial, and hit the baby with his rifle butt. The witness, concerned about his own safety, kept quiet for 2 days until the platoon was back at its base camp. Then he told the story to a legal officer. 5 members of the squad were prosecuted. All were found guilty, but only one, the man who shot the raped woman, received a life sentence. Over the long years of the Vietnam War, other soldiers and Marines were prosecuted in military courts and sent to military prisons for such crimes. But in comparison to the staggering slaughter of Vietnamese, Laotian and Cambodians also, civilians by American air and ground forces, the attempt to prosecute crimes against noncombatants was laughable, a flimsy cosmetic of international law. The war was against civilians. Its purpose was to win hearts and minds through fear and terror. A favorite expression among American troops was, "Grab them by the bleep, and their hearts and minds will follow." If in their own fear and terror most of the Americans sensed they were doing wrong, and that later would be a psychic cost. But guilt was regarded as a luxury of survival, and to survive superseded every other consideration. It was easy to turn it around and believe that virtually all Vietnamese who regarded the Americans as invaders and murderers would try to kill them if they got a chance. It is ironic the survivors have such a high suicide rate, one of the highest for a single group. It has been estimated that almost as many Vietnam veterans have taken their own lives in the States as were killed in the war. The number is too high, another suspicious body count associated with Vietnam. And although it seems almost common knowledge and often cited, actual proof of how many have suicided is elusive and should not diminish the terrible individual and local cost. Guilt and fear are two of the ingredients for veteran suicide, so are despair and emptiness. The heavy use of alcohol and drugs to dull the pain exacerbates the problems, so must also the long-term effects of chemical poisons sprayed to defoliate the jungle. Almost 40 years since the war's end in 1975, the U.S. government continues to deny that anyone was catastrophically exposed, and the Veterans Administration, which has disgraced itself with its insensitive treatment of Vietnam veterans, yet refuses to recognize any other symptom than a skin rash from the defoliants, some of which were the most toxic devised. Vets have died. Their children are born malformed. Headaches, spells of vertigo or dizziness, unexplained periods of violent behavior are a few of the disorders traced to herbicide exposure. It is proof of the contempt nations and states have for the individuals/masses in their armies. Good metal is not used for a nail, nor a good man for a soldier, is an ancient maxim from China. American soldiers were deliberately poisoned to destroy an enemy. That remains despite all the denials. Louis Cahan suffered it all. His were classic symptoms: depression, isolation, rage, the inability to love, spiritual desolation, survival guilt, and nightmares that kept him from wanting to sleep. He went a little farther than most, like Callie and his platoon, stacked up more bodies in a single place than most American units, excepting long-range artillery and airstrikes. An after effect of the mere gook rule, the racism against all Asians and against Vietnamese in particular that began in training for Khe Hanh and most of the other 3 million men and women who were sent to Southeast Asia has had an after effect in ugly friction between Vietnam veterans and Vietnamese refugees. The antipathy was intensified by the dread of fighting guerrillas who struck and disappeared like phantoms and by the great toll taken by booby traps and concealed anti-personnel mines. Revenge was more often than not brutally exacted upon innocent civilians in countless villages. Even the least among the Americans was convinced he, or she, was far superior to all Vietnamese. Gục was a word that dehumanized Vietnamese and made it easier to kill them without provocation, much the same as the word pig allowed the anti-war movement in the States to despise all cops. The antipathy against Vietnamese did not end with the war. For thousands of Vietnam veterans, it remains a grim legacy that continues to disrupt and destroy. More than 1 million Southeast Asians suffered great loss and deprivation to reach the United States. Perhaps as many as 500,000 perished on the open ocean or in refugee camps in which they were imprisoned for months or years. In the U.S., they have undergone hostility and resentment, but the immigrants have responded with a hard-working determination to earn their way and are, as a result, a new vitality in an entropied culture. It has not been easy for them and might never be, yet they persist. 2 years after Li Ma-Han's death, her parents gave birth to another daughter. One of the hardest adjustments in this country is to discover that the American people, particularly the veterans, are frustrated by the war so that they identify all Vietnamese as communists, Le Tan Huang said a few months after his daughter Mai Han died. They want to forget the war, and they do not make necessary distinctions between the communists and the refugees who fled to look for freedom. We still have 3 children and need to look to the future. This is our first generation. There will be a second generation and a third in this country. A lost war of a previous century seems of little consequence almost 40 years later, though it remains embarrassing and its problems continue to affect the generation that fought in it and against it. The Vietnam veteran is living proof of not only the war's intolerable costs, but also its sinister purpose. It is not only that Vietnam veterans have been treated shabbily on the whole or unfairly made to bear the nation's iniquities. It is that they are the crippled products of a war that never ends for them. That is what we must learn. And much of the research into the murder of Li Ma-Han by Louis Khe Hanh has been provided by a book, Aftershocks, A Tale of Two Victims by David Howard Bain, published by Methuen in New York. Now I'd like to read again something else I have written. And I like to read it in honor of all the May Day demonstrations all over the country yesterday, and particularly in Portland, which is just over the range from us. And I wrote it a couple of years ago. I call it Occupy Astoria. If anyone thinks police attacks, arrests, and displacements in several American cities have disintegrated the Occupy Wall Street movement, they should be reminded that the anti-Vietnam War movement was attacked hundreds of times all over the country by police and National Guards, but it never quit and ultimately, despite official repulsion, greatly contributed not only to America's withdrawal from the war, but also changed the country. The Occupy movement is not simply related to real estate, but of the minds and hearts of increasing millions of Americans, a revolutionary method of organizing political and cultural change in a horizontal rather than hierarchical manner. Sheila Harper of Astoria expresses it this way: "We are pushing up against real change. It is time to change our thinking from material wealth to a personal and social wealth." And as an Occupy protester said in New York 2 years ago, we are the 99%. We are the blood of this country. This country cannot live without us. The only real distinction of this country is not wealth or power, but the fact the great majority of ordinary people who do not have much wealth are the fundamental source of government power. Yet the wealthy minority dangerously fool themselves that their money entitles them to authoritarian control as a corollary to wealth. This beleaguered democracy must be reformed or replaced with structures of greater personal liberties that are simultaneously more civically, politically, and economically equitable, a delicate balance that is always fragile and subject to deformity. Our Constitution contains much of what is needed to repair the crushing inequity that impairs our society, but it tends to be used to protect privilege and the dominance of whoever possesses it. Yet the Arab Spring has shown that once certain dynamics fall into place, change occurs rapidly, particularly when hopes of freedom and equality are given a chance. Capitalist democracy is falling apart from its own contradictions, just as Russian communism did. Democracy and capitalism were extolled as the same principle during the Cold War. The instant Russia collapsed, the rich in America revived the ancient war against the non-rich, which has greatly intensified, especially following the collapse and bailouts of Wall Street. The vast majority of American citizens are oppressed by a wealthy gentry whose sole purpose is to use money to make money rather than produce products and pay wages, and believes that its own interests are all that matter. Money is sucked up from everybody else to the wealthy caste, who use it for the specific purpose of further enriching themselves in financial markets. As Will Rogers famously said, there is as much money as there always has been, but fewer got it. An accelerating disparity between the wealthy and everyone else, and the use of the law and politics to oppress the deprived, endangers the remaining democracy and equity in this country. Economic inequality is not a natural phenomenon, but is premeditated policy, such as is first-degree murder. The bankers and financiers who caused the economic catastrophe that has plunged millions of Americans into jobless and homeless poverty have emerged incredibly more wealthy, essentially because the ordinary citizens they have pillaged have unwillingly and without consent been forced to bail them out with tax money they have lost control over. Instead of being tried as criminals, these wealthy elites purchase not only the corrupt minds and shriveled souls of elected lawmakers, but also the law itself. It is pertinent that Astorians participate in the Occupy movement. After all, John Jacob Astor was not only America's first millionaire, he was also its first multimillionaire. He made his money in furs, real estate. He was called the nation's first slumlord, and high finance, and was most likely an original investor on Wall Street. And if that is not enough, some of his descendants purchased English royalty in direct contravention of America's cherished claim of classlessness. The latest Lord Astor visited Astoria for its bicentennial celebration 2 years ago in 2011. And a little subquote, as John Kenneth Galbraith put it, quote, "The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness." And I'd like to close this off. With a poem. To those who have gone home tired. After the streets fall silent, after the bruises and the tear-gassed eyes are healed, after the consensus has returned, after the memories of Kent State and My Lai and Hiroshima lose their power and their connections with each other, and the sweaters labeled made in Taiwan, after the last American dies in Canada and the last Korean in prison and the last Indian at Pine Ridge, after the last whale is emptied from the sea and the last leopard emptied from its skin and the last drop of blood refined by Exxon, after the last iron door clangs hangs shut behind the last conscience, and the last loaf of bread is hammered into bullets, and the bullets scattered among the hungry, what answers will you find? What armor will protect you when your children ask you why? And that was by W.D. Earhart, Vietnam veteran and a member of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and an old friend of mine. And this has been Michael McCusker. I suppose I'll be back next Thursday if a few certain things that I think might happen prophesy, like a drone incinerating me on the sidewalk one of these days, or sky falling on me, or myself falling into the river.